This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Tuesday, December 30th, this is the final arts track with Bruce Herman, Bobby Gross, Karin Coonrod, and John Rapson.
So this is our last hour together, and first we're going to have Dayton Castleman, who's a visual artist, but he's married to a wonderful dancer, say a word about my...
Yeah, and I was able to make it to the track for the first night, and the rest of my time has been sort of swallowed up coordinating the after-hours art events. So I'm sorry that I haven't been able to be here, but I wanted to plug tonight's... it's going to kick off with... Brian Moss, who's the leader of the worship band, doing some of his original work for a short set, and then there are going to be three performance pieces, two fairly straight dance works, and then one final work that is more performative, more theatrical, and especially chose this track as the one I'm first to plug it to. Because you are on the art track. So it would be awesome if you guys supported. It's not quite the marathon, the beautiful, incredible marathon that Juliet was. So you wouldn't be out till 12:30 or anything like that. It would be about 45 minutes or so. But we'd love to keep it coming. Good arts.
Including the wonderful wife.
Yeah, me and my wife, Karin, dances for a company here in Chicago. All three pieces were choreographed for the conference. They're original pieces, two of them were choreographed by a fellow dancer with my wife at a company called Hubbard Street Dance Chicago, and then the other is a friend of ours. Some people have heard of Hubbard Street. Awesome.
I love it. Yeah, you're
getting there. Good stuff. Nice. So, Katie can fill you in on how awesome it's going to be. After I so, thanks for the
Actually, I'd like us to stay in a spirit of prayer and thinking about the words we heard today, Christ in you, in us, the hope of glory, and a chorus that comes to mind based on a text from Isaiah 6:3, holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of His glory. So now we could just take a moment and continue in prayer, bow your heads with me, and reflect on ways we experience His glory in each other, in community, in exploring our faith and learning together. I'll sing once. Alone, we'll have a pause afterwards and listen. Holy, 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 God of power and might. Holy, 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 God of power and might. Heaven and earth are full. Oh.
it's impossible to really summarize our time together, and even more impossible to try to in any way encapsulate what we've been experiencing these days with Bishop Wright and our other wonderful presenters. I think a wonderful way to end our time together is to go to this dance performance and see how the body is incarnating all the things that we're talking about. What I'd like to do now, this is a very short presentation. It's both very, very simple, but also extremely complex. And I think it was divinely inspired after a fashion in the mind of this theologian that has had a huge impact on my own thinking, maybe before he teaches at Cambridge University. He's written a book entitled Self and Salvation, Being Transformed. I highly recommend it. Cambridge University Press. And it's pretty dense. It's pretty heavy sledding. So I will say this. I've read this book twice now, and I feel like the second time I read it, I had this strange experience that I'd never read before. And I read it carefully the first time. So it's one of those books that it's like Bishop Wright's talks. Just add water, and you get 16 gallons. And it's just this concentrate. Another book that's had a huge impact on my thinking is a set of essays by Gadamer, a German philosopher, entitled The Relevance of the Beautiful. And that's also the Cambridge University Press. The Relevance of the Beautiful. Ford has, in this book, there's no way I can do justice to the overall arching pattern of the book and the vision that he has. But essentially what he's arguing for is the self really doesn't exist in and of itself, autonomously. There is no autonomous self. It's a fiction. The individualist is actually heavily dependent on others around him. And in fact, there is no self that is separate from other selves. The self only comes into being in relationship. And that reality of the interdependence of selves, the non-autonomous self, is grounded in God. God is not an autonomous self. The Trinity is one of the deepest, most profound reality. It is the deepest, most profound reality. It is unfathomable. It's mind-bending, but it's also neatly accessible. That's what I meant by simple and yet extremely complex. It's the thing that's right in front of us. In fact, right in front of me right now, I'm looking at your wonderful faces, and I'm realizing there's a little community that's formed the last few days. And that's the next thing I'd like to say is, he talks about this self without idols. The idea that when you are in genuine relationship with other selves, when you open yourself up to others, you don't need to make them into an idol. You don't need to put them up on a pedestal. You don't need to have people who will be your great one that you bow down to. Whether a guru, literally a guru, or some guru in a figurative sense of the word. You don't need a celebrity culture if you can live open to others, truly open to others. It's only when you need to objectify others and make them be something to you. In other words, use other people instead of love them or enter a relationship with them that you need idols. I could say more about that, but I won't, because it's a really complex, but I think you get it. You put someone up on a pedestal if you can't really deal with them as a human being. The greatest way to have your idols crash and also yourself as an idol to crash is to get married. Or live in an apartment for an extended period of time with somebody. Really live in community. You find very quickly that people are clay vessels. So no idols. The next step that he talks about in this vision of the self, the interdependent self, is the hospitable self. Now that's a natural outcome of living without idols, is you become more transparent yourself. You're more open. Your person is more there, present. You're not distancing yourself from others, and so you're actually coming and making yourself available. You're welcoming others. And you're interested in the other. You're not narcissistic. So you're actually hospitable. You're opening yourself to include others. In a sense, you almost are reaching out and identifying with the other at some point. In that hospitable state where your mind, your emotions, even your body becomes welcome to the other. And of course, the ultimate form of, again, it's not an accident that in the Bible, our God refers to himself as the bridegroom and the church as the bride. The ultimate kind of openness, the ultimate hospitality to another human being is to accept them into yourself, as it were, to be in, not to merge and lose yourself entirely in that person, but to be in harmony in the most profound sense. And of course, marriage is a wonderful metaphor for that, but it's also a reality. The next thing that naturally flows from this hospitable stance or posture toward others is what David Ford calls the singing self. That may be a little bit of a leap for us at this point. You're going to the next octave, as it were. But think about it. What did we just do? We sat together, and it was the most natural thing in the world because we are open to one another. We have been over the last few days. I sense it. I see it. There's a lot of laughter. We've been sharing with each other. We're going to do some more sharing tonight. But this singing self is, that's the natural urge, once you've opened yourself to another, is to harmonize with them. And I mean that literally. I think David Ford means that literally, issues in song. And if you think about the monasteries in the Middle Ages, song was a unifying device. It was all about prayer, but it was also about coming together and in a sense being one with the others. Because you can be one in music, you can be one when you subject yourself to a common melody, to a common vibration. Your body becomes literally the medium of that hospitality at that point. And it naturally results in song. The next step of this maturation that Ford talks about in this interdependent understanding of selfhood is the worshiping self, which naturally comes out of the singing self. They're all coterminous. They're not really distinct in some airtight sense, but it's helpful to make these distinctions. Because when you open yourself up to others, you enter into genuine community with them. You want to sing with them, and you want to come before your Creator together, side by side. It's a natural outcome of your maturing as a self, because you have opened yourself to the others. And then you've harmonized with them, and ultimately you want to come together before our Creator and worship. It's the most natural thing. In fact, Scripture says that that's what we were created for. It's not so much even that God needs our worship in some sense, but we need to worship. That's what it's like. It's like our breath. It's the true breath, the Ruach, the Spirit of God that issues in this worship. And then finally, the ultimate form of maturation, he calls it Eucharistic self, in which literally you give yourself away. And I'm sure all of these things happen in stages, and they all happen in part at different points of our life with Christ. But to me, this is the most profound idea that I've ever encountered. That in fact, we are meant to become food for one another. We're meant to give ourselves away, to become Eucharist in the world. And then beyond even the church, literally the church is to become Eucharist. We are meant to be broken, and to feed the lost, those who don't know God. Because while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us, and he says, follow me. So these are profound ideas. Obviously, we could probably work on this for years now. So a few minutes like this just isn't sufficient. But I wanted to ask a question here of all of us. What difference does this make for us as artists? What difference does it make for our art making? What are the implications of that for our conference in flourishing? I'll just open it up for a few minutes, and then after we've had a chance to maybe think about this, talk about it together a little bit, I'd like maybe John and Karen, if you have things you want to add, but anybody. And then I'd like to we have a couple of people here tonight who want to share a little bit with us from their own work. I'd ask four different people to do a little show and tell, kind of like what Karen and John and I have done, a little more brief, but it'll give you a sense of what is issuing out of these people's lives, and also will be, I think, a beautiful way for us to end our time together to see what other people are doing. I wish we had time for everyone to share something out of their own work, because I just know there's a lot of fertile soil that's been growing new living things here among us. So, anyhow.
Bruce, will you put that list of different cells up there?
Sure. Yeah. Right.
About
any one of these.
Can I just clarify a little bit more of how you're talking about Sabbath?
Yeah, I see. The speaker had been talking about this idea of cosmic rest, that and ceasing from productivity and saying, okay, my identity is not my work. I'm not, this is not the source of who I am, and therefore I can cease from work. I can not get things done that I would otherwise get done on this day. I can, if I'm a farmer, I can refrain from harvesting things that are going to spoil me from my work. And trust that God will still sustain me because it will help me in my work and existence. That answers your question.
It does some, and I just want to expand a notion of Sabbath that has to do with quiet in our minds. Certainly observing that day in a sense of not working in the example that we create order. Well, why did God create in 7 days? It wasn't for us. He could have done it like this, right? Or the story, even whether we consider it myth or not. It's a pattern for human beings about working and allowing ourselves to be able to see things in stages slowly enough, patient enough to call them good and so on. But I think that the absolute necessity of Sabbath in order to not just to not find our identity in work and to say that this is not as important as I want it to be or whatever, but that whole aspect of which we see ourselves through the eyes of God that comes from being quiet enough, I think is an important aspect of making Sabbath a routine of every day.
Like what you said about God's provision, the farmer can rest even risking the loss of crops that God provide. And I think if there's one, I mean, if that's the, excuse me, that's the story of the entire Bible, which is we really don't believe God's going to provide for us. So we grumble, we ask for something else, we want the human king because the divine king isn't visible, so we can't, et cetera, fill in the blank. But it's all about us second guessing God, not really believing that he's going to provide for us. So we're going to make a name for ourselves. We're going to get a little confidence. Any other responses to Ford's insight about the interdependent self?
I see one other thing that I've gotten thinking about, and that is that a lot of current scholarship, at least of the last 3 years, has been dealing with identity studies and how they're socially formed and how they're geographically formed, how they're professionally formed, the variety of ways that we come to say that we have this self, as it were. And I think that the gospel radically challenges that, not in the sense that we don't do those things. That is, we're parents, we're teachers, we're members of the city and all the rest. But rather, what it means to find our identity in Christ. Because those are fictional constructions of self by its very nature. And I think that fictional creation of an identity is one that necessarily needs to have affirmation. And the very thing that you're talking about, Sabbath, is one of the ways of quieting ourselves away from that need to feed a fictional construction of identity.
Yeah. Has anyone heard of Paul Tournier, the Swiss psychologist? He makes a distinction between person and personage. And the personage is the mask we wear that we all construct in order to deal with our for the world. But the person is our true self, as we understand it. But that true self is not safe unless you let down your guard, unless you feel like you let down your guard with something. So you need to build up this.
And that true
fictional self is
that is a maker in the mind of Christ is not threatened. That is the very place that I come. For me, when I'm doing music, it is most often where I am making my connection with Christ, with God. It is not the assembly of my identity, per se, but rather the place in which the runner, famous runner, Charles. Yeah, I feel his pleasure in, you know, the quotation of David that is there. That is a fundamental distinction.
Codgers in the room resemble that remark.
So, you know, the visual arts, unlike the other arts, has a place where Christians are
I think we're. I always say this. That I think our
but it occurs to me we may be in the very beginnings of a flowering of Christian contribution to civilization that's never been seen before. I sense that there's tremendous fertility right now. And even as the economy tanks, things seem to be getting worse. Christianity was made for hard times. It was not made for mission times. This is an anomaly, this 100 years of well-being in the United States. American Christianity is not normal in the history of the church. So I think we may have an opportunity, folks, to be the ones who begin to model this different way, this Christly way in our heart, in our way together. Watching Karen's presentation recently, I got choked up because I saw it being refreshed. I saw it happening before my very eyes. I mean, I actually saw it. I was remembering it physically. I have muscle memory of being on the streets in our ghetto and walking around with people. And then also, the project working, the experience I had working with students on my Mary project, the Magnificat project, was a remarkable experience. I don't want to give up. Other thoughts? Yes.
I just keep looking at the ecosystem and kind of flipping it on its side a little bit, because I was thinking about kind of the work that I do, and I really didn't think about this way before. I think about it as kind of interesting, but every line, every character in the story, they tell you.
Showing interest in what it is that I'm trying to do. And
can take that even a step further to those people that you don't want to hear. You know, maybe perhaps somebody that you struggle with, whether it's at odds with your aesthetic or at odds with your technique or at odds with the kind of competition that you have, whatever those are, there's nothing more hospitable than to show up and have interest in their work. And to me, this is a binding of the church that seems pretty simple for most of us to do, but nonetheless a decision that's easy to rationalize away from. I know in my own school, I think we probably do upwards of 50 to 60 jazz performances a year, and over 300 performances in the School of Music. I can't remember the exact name. Do you know Gabriel? I mean, so it's easy to say, wow, it's too much to go to. I got to pick and choose. And most often when I get caught in that particular decision-making mode, I'm going to choose my own kind, right? And so that's one simple thing I think that is a avoiding.
I'm not sure if I'm going to need a microphone or not, too. So my name is Nick Burkhart, and I'm an artist. But one of the things that I'm just thinking about this type of communal art making has been something that I've been introduced to in the last just a year or two, really. Just seeing as a Christian I can incorporate the work of other people's art in a way that I can respond to it and make my own original pieces based off of those either dance pieces or compositions and music, and I'm just still trying to explore what it might mean in theater and all that. But one of the humbling things and scary things about collaborating with other people is that you don't know where it's going. you give up a certain level of control over the end result because of the fact that you're dealing with another person's artwork. And I know, as an artist, I have an idea of how my work might turn out or could turn out. And it's a whole lot easier to make decisions from when I'm the only person involved in the work. But once you start bringing everybody else into it, theater is just a really good example of that, and especially dance and music. It's modeled better in those disciplines a lot of times than just the visual arts. But there was a word that I came across that has to deal with music. It's antiphon. It's a part of liturgical music that was used in a worship service. I'm still trying to learn more about that. Maybe not an expert on that, but what that is a part of a worship service or part of a musical piece in that context where there's a call and response to everything, where there sometimes a leader calls out and then the congregation drops in response. And that's an attitude that I've been taking in these collaborative efforts. And The work that I'm going to show is just a recent thing. I did this less than a month ago, and the images that I'm going to show are digital photographs, but I also took film, black and white film photographs of these, and have been developing these compositions by myself. But I wasn't expecting it to show in this, so I have those.
I'm going to have to be the bad guy and call time on all of this. Just wanted to double three of you. But we can collectively decide whether we're going to keep going. But I think we need to clear out of here at about 10:20, which will get down to 10.
So anyway, in this project, I was collaborating with a friend of mine, Lindsay Ferguson, who was a dancer, and
for one of her final projects in her career at my college, choreographed a piece to perform at a student concert. And what I did was I sat in on the concert and enjoyed being there and being a part of the dance performance, but I also did a sketch, an ink sketch of a little bit of the movement and just tracing the path and the history of her body through the space that is a part of dance. And so I had these lines and this drawing that I scanned in then to a computer and then printed it off on a transparency. And we went into a lighting studio and I projected her dance on her as she danced the piece again and then recorded this through photography. And so these are two primary.
Nick, will you tell the rest of our folks about how she responded? She had done this dance without your projection initially, right?
Yeah. She originally performed the piece under studio lighting in theater on stage, separated from the rest of the audience, obviously by the barrier, by being put on stage. And one of the things that she was especially struck by performing this piece in this light drawing studio was that the studio itself put her on the same plane as me, as her audience, and really brought a humanizing effect to her performance. And the floors were wooden, so it was creaking, and you started to get an idea of her presence in the space. And it was really, really interesting for me to just capture the history of this entire expression and seeing how my art could relate to her art and collectively make both pieces strong. So that was a really fun process, and I'm going to keep on exploring this way of thinking and these images, especially the black and white. To give you an idea of there we go. This is a little bit of the setup. It's pretty basic. It's just an overhead projector and what you'd see in class back in the day. And you just
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Two thoughts on this, one being that it's a piece of choral music which fits in with our whole subject of collaboration and community by its nature, but also on the theme of brokenness and beauty, which Bruce was speaking about. I wrote this piece in June of 2004 at a workshop, actually, for choral composers and singers and conductors. And it was in response to learning the news of a friend of mine who I knew was expecting a child, and then learned very unexpectedly that the child died and was born silently. And thinking about the seasons of life and how often they don't come in the order that we expect, and yet they come in divine order. And I wrestled with a way to put this in musical form. I took the idea with me to this particular workshop. But I didn't have a text, and I was wrestling with different ones. Nothing was speaking in just the right way. Until I came upon the Ecclesiastes text, "To everything there is a season, the times and the purposes of heaven." And the idea of a recurring refrain of the seasons in an order we don't expect, and then bringing into that the phrases of that text from Ecclesiastes. So the piece is called "The Circle of Time." This performance is from the chorale at the University of Hartford, which was performed the year after it was written. Thank you.
realized you turned up the VA. Sorry.
So as artists, everyone interacts with the world and materials, and I think
think as artists we have the ability to approach everything we interact with love. And so to me, art is love tangibly expressed. And that's really what we want to do at this residency program. So it's a little cut off. But we have a small farm with a very large barn, 13,000 square feet, stone barn, over just about 200 years old. They're renovating into studio space and gallery space. And there's a farmhouse that was initially designed as an inn that we're converting and adding in addition to house 8 to 10 residents for a 9-month residency program, which would be intended post-baccalaureate or second-generation artists, people who are leaving other careers and get back into developing the human currency. And I think one of the key things that we're interested in is participating in the redemption of God's creation, that as we engage with these materials and each other, we're doing this thing. So we're trying to preserve as much of the original character of this place. As much of the character of this place as possible, but really bring it up and make it an excellent place to seriously play what we were talking about here. So adequate lighting for the studios, equipment is involved in the gallery space, and building strong relationships with local and regional galleries and churches. A lot of this equipment that we have found is kind of neglected. We like to talk about redemptive reuse or civilized dumpster diving. And for example, like 3 weeks ago, we just purchased an entire metal shop from this guy who didn't want it anymore. It was his grandfather who had fallen into great disrepair. And so he sold it to us for really cheap just to get rid of it. And it's going to take a lot of work, like hundreds and hundreds of hours of restoring these tools, but we take great joy. That's part of what we believe it is to be an artist and to love each other and this world and bringing everything into the fullness of God's character and really learning what his character is even beyond what we already know. Not much of a theologian, so I'm maybe saying something radical, but I think as an artist, I feel like I'm really able to pursue things and communicate truth to myself, let alone to other people, about who God is and how he works, like goes beyond words. I think we would all agree with that. 2 minutes. So these are just some of the spaces that are planned. This would be the library classroom space, double height space in the shed part of the barn. So there would be wood shop, metal shop, ceramic studio, drawing and painting studios, a photography lab, and quite a bit of flexible space where as artists come in, if they have needs, we can adjust for those needs. But time would be allocated throughout the working week, mostly just in studio working and challenging each other and talking about ideas. And then 2 or 3 days a week would be it. Mornings of the week would be in a classroom talking about readings, inviting guest lecturers, people we agree with, disagree with, but kind of provoke thought and challenge some things. And a lot of this is still just forming. The curriculum, money, we don't have much of that figured out, but we know that God has provided this vision and this farm, and there's a lot of passion and a lot of energy. It's really exciting to be a part of, and I'm really humbled to be a part of it. I just graduated from Green Architecture in the spring, and this family invited me to, they're feeding me and housing me, and they're great designers, and I'm just kind of putting images to what we are all coming up with, but it's really exciting to be a part of it. So in 2 years, we're hoping to start if money and equipment is provided. So if any of you are interested, it'll be a pretty dynamic, diverse place to just think and make. And I'd love to see more of your work. It's in Pennsylvania. Sorry, I didn't say Pennsylvania.
But what part of
Pennsylvania? It's
on the border of Chester County and Lancaster County, so it's about an hour west of Philadelphia, part of Amish country, and a really peaceful place, but it's within train ride of Philadelphia to New York for under $100, so they're pretty accessible to broader scales of community. So, I'm excited.
Our next presentation is by John Trotter, if we can get his materials loaded.
There's a little bit of a mystery as to whether or not this will actually work, so we're going to give it a try.
So while they're trying, I start yakking.
Yak away.
I didn't expect to present, because I don't have most of what I have, and most of what I do have won't work, and that of which we do have that may work may not work. So... So, I'm actually looking forward to not, as Bruce was saying, not standing up and promoting myself and talking about all the things I do. I thought once about giving a workshop about sort of the difference between the subjective experience of being an artist and the objective experience of being an artist, because we look out at artists when we read their biographies and their artist statements and see their work, and it seems like they go from success to success and just create one finished beautiful product after another, and then we sit down to work, and some days seem entirely wasted, and we change direction, and we lose confidence, and we come close to losing faith sometimes. And I thought once about having two biographies, both true, of me, right? One of them, so John Trotter has conducted these amazing groups and done these wonderful things and won these wonderful prizes. And then over here, you know, John Trotter has three times turned down for the following application and was denied entrance to all the... And they both be true, right? To try to shake...
Spend 3 hours watching a football game.
Yeah. One thing that I'm very interested in... So I'm a musician. That's not obvious. I do write music. I do improvise and work with people who improvise or would like to improvise, but I'm also called, to borrow a phrase from the video we saw a couple years ago, to be a steward of classical music, to be somebody who communicates these incredible monuments, which just stagger me, especially choral orchestra music. I work with both choirs and orchestras. When they combine to give utterance to especially old texts, but also very inspired new texts written in, there is nothing like that. Now, that is their confluence of, say, 100 people with, you know, old school skills that can only be learned over a decade or two. It's not something you can just throw together. It's not a kid with a paint box. And it's not something that can be done anywhere at any time. And I recognize that that's a problem. You know, that's a logistical problem in the world, especially a world that wants quick results, that wants things to be reproducible, and all that kind of thing. But I love it. And so far I've been given opportunities to do that, and I would love to be doing it. So until God kicks me out of that, because he kicked me into it, I had no intention of being a professional musician at all. Law school was my destination, quite clearly. Until he kicks me out of that, that's what I'll be doing. Now, most of the music that is like I've just described is sacred music, right? It's the sacred texts. I've never worked in a church. So I'm dealing with doing sacred music, sometimes in sacred spaces and sometimes not, with performers who represent a wide variety of, shall we call them, faith traditions, but most of them are not actually traditional. Most of them are brand new. I think I made up this thing that I like a lot. I made up this new God in my own image, and it's pretty pleasing to me. And dealing with that, and this music, which was made by people whose faith very often was not Christian, you know, very strong, very, who chose their biblical texts to express themselves. Now, I never hear the Brahms Requiem without learning something new about God. To me, that piece is a theological education. And I, without stepping on people's own faith traditions, I find it really important that they encounter the truth of those texts, so that they can sing knowledgeably about what's going on. And everybody was born, and everybody dies, and everybody knows that they brought nothing into the world, and they're taking nothing out. And these texts often deal with exactly that issue. So even folks who might have, in principle, a problem with those texts, I've got to be some sense moved by, you know,
have mercy on me, naked we came in, and naked we will return, and all those things. Now, this, which is the smallest file I have on my computer,
which might possibly work.
No, maybe. It's
Oh,
yeah,
sorry. Turn the speaker on. We'll try this again. Is there any way I can control it? Because it's too long.
Music.
Can I skip it at all? Can I skip the timeline?
Sure. Oh, look, it's up there. Okay, this is the Windsor Classic Chorale in Southern Ontario, a commuting distance from where I live. It's the Remembrance Day concert. It's the Veterans Day in this country, Remembrance Day in Canada.
The power of music. No matter whether they support the current conflicts or they oppose the current conflicts, this is a place we could all be together. We could all grieve together. And we could all think together about what it means to have a world where we believe the words, lest we forget.
I'm going to jump ahead here. So we have...
Defending our nation.
I brought a high school in, which I'll talk about in a sec, to be a part of the project. It wasn't part of the original plan.
The concert music spanned 500 years, from the 15th to the 20th century.
It's important to be able to draw solace from the fact that other people have written about and thought about these things and lived through them and pass their thoughts on to us, and we can, by performing the music, take it in and then share it again. I think that helps.
One thing I'm really interested in is, I guess from how much I love sacred music, is how to connect people with all the stuff in that sacred music that they can easily connect to, and helping them avoid that knee-jerk response they may have that it's got nothing to do with them. So Remembrance Day concert, lots of people in both our countries have died in recent conflicts, and people are feeling pretty close to that issue. I was told when I was brought on as a guest conductor for this program that it's not a sacred program, it's a civic program. And so at first I was like, okay, so that means a secular program. And then I thought, wait, the word secular has no meaning to me. You know, what does it mean to say we're remembering dead people? But the 93% of people who believe in a God in our countries, you know, we can't have any reference to the fact that there might be a being. But this is a concept for 7% of our civic population. Okay. What would that mean? So I did program some sacred music. I did write a message from the director in the program about peace, about how we each have responsibility for peace, about how we can think within ourselves about the things we do that are obstructive to peace, and about how we have to walk through the darkness to get to the light. And that wasn't like a Christian sermon, but I felt like there were things I could safely say that are part of the Christian understanding, that aren't part of sort of a smug finger-pointing, remembering today, you guys are causing war, and you know, if you were running the world, it wouldn't be that way. And then, most importantly, presenting these artworks to them, sung by people in their community, with these words so incredibly well said. I must stop talking now, and I will.
But I'll gladly listen. Thank you so much. That's great. Well, we're very short on time, but I just wanted to personally say thank you so much for your attention and your investment in our time together. I know I speak for my friends here the same. We do want to pray quickly before we go, and Bobby, maybe you can lead us in prayer.
And let's take our chance to thank Karen, John, and Bruce. Did everybody get to make sure their name is on that email list? Is
yeah, well, we're trying to get a... Oh! Marcus. Lovely. Regarding being connected and all that, I thought it was great.
Okay. So just grab one from Chandra on the way out.
Who didn't get a book?
That's
raise your
right.
hand or get anyone.
Get a book. Right. Take a book. Here, I'll help you pass them out.
I'm not taking this from
home. Albert, do you have one? Who's keeping it also? Marcus.
Okay, would you stand with me? Holy, holy, holy. Lord God, you are. So we humble ourselves before you in that humility. By your grace, you would cause us to flourish, and as we flourish, we would contribute to the flourishing of the men and women around us who you love with your whole being.
Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Blessings.